Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
It doesn't get any more American than religious freedom, that topic. It's more American than apple pie and hot dogs.
The whole sexual revolution requires so much propaganda. They require propaganda because what they are advocating is not sustainable naturally.
The writers and the producers of contemporary Christian music are not ashamed of their mysticism. They are mystics. They're proud of it. They're not trying to hide it. If you said, hey, that song is mystical, they'd say, thank you.
And I think the Ascension shows us very clearly that heaven is our final destiny, but that heaven is already here among us because Christ is among us, and he will never leave us or forsake us.
Swedish Lutheran lawyers love Issues Etc. while bike commuting to work in Stockholm, Sweden. Thank you, America, for supporting Europe in this very hard time.
The one-year anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Dobbs v. Jackson is approaching. And the big question is, what has changed? A lot of us have a general sense of what has changed. Of course, Roe is no more. That's a huge change in and of itself. But what has changed when it comes to abortion in the United States, and what hasn't changed? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, June the 23rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the one-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision with Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Dr. Michael New of the Charlotte Lozier Institute will join us after that. There's a new survey on abortion views and a new report on abortions post-Dobbs. Then Pastor Chris Roseborough will be alongside. It's This Week in Pop Christianity. We'll talk about the charismatic lust for miracles, signs, and wonders. Then Delano Squires of the Heritage Foundation will join us, and we'll talk about the necessity of fathers. Dr. Ryan Anderson is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, founder and editor of The Public Discourse, and co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solved Nothing. Dr. Anderson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How would you describe the status of abortion in the U.S. 1 year after the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Dobbs?
Well, it's better than it was a year ago, but it's still fundamentally unjust. In all 50 states, we lack adequate protections, because in none of the states do we actually have a full ban on abortion with full protections for every child in the womb. But in many of the states, we're much better than we were. We had laws that sprang into effect the minute that Dobbs was enacted, or in some cases, it was 30 days after the Dobbs decision was announced. Since then, we've had several states pass more protective laws. I mean, we've seen in the course of 1 year, Florida pass a 15-week pain-capable bill, and then just a few months ago, they made it a 6-week heartbeat bill. That's yet to go into effect, but you can see that we're making incremental progress. And just earlier this week, there was a study that came out that showed that there were, I believe it was 90,000 fewer abortions in the states that have these protective laws. But then unfortunately, there were 60,000 more abortions in the states that don't have the protective laws. But that meant an overall bottom line increase of 30,000 fewer abortions from where we were a year ago. That's 30,000 additional babies that were brought to term that are now living. So when you say, you know, what's the status of abortion in the U.S. a year after the Dobbs ruling, we're better than where we were a year ago, but there are still hundreds of thousands of abortions, and probably even more that we don't know of because of the rise of chemical abortions, right? So the only reporting requirements that we have are for surgical abortions. And so that just means there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done.
What's been the impact of our 50-year experiment with abortion on demand?
Sure. I mean, the subtitle of the book that you mentioned really gives our talking point, our one-line summary of that. It's that it's harmed everything and it has solved nothing. Everything that abortion has touched during the past 50 years, it has made worse. And nothing that abortion has touched has it touched for the better. And what Alexandra and I do in the book is we just walk through area by area. And obviously, the first chapter focuses on the unborn child, because obviously abortion has been a disaster for the unborn child because it kills the unborn child. Then the next chapter focuses on women. Abortion has been a disaster for women. It's been a disaster in the way that men can now use and abuse women, can view women as, well, if it's her body, it's her choice, and it's her problem. So many men walking away from their sexual partners no longer necessarily having to be their spouses, their wife, a variety of ways in which modern feminism takes the male body as the norm and therefore views female bodies as somehow defective males. And this is where you see both contraception and abortion all as technological solutions to try to make women more like men. It's been a disaster for people on the periphery of life, people with disabilities, female babies. Baby girls are aborted at much higher rates than baby boys with a sex-selective discriminatory abortion. I already mentioned disability discriminatory abortion. And then we have huge racial disparities with abortion. Some of this is from the eugenic roots of Planned Parenthood. When you look at the founder, Margaret Sanger, it's been terrible for healthcare and for medicine. It's corrupted the practice of medicine. It's corrupted our politics. So many pro-life Americans feel trapped between one political party that takes them for granted and the other political party that despises them. And wouldn't it be nice if pro-lifers had a meaningful political choice between two political parties? It's been a disaster for constitutional law. I mean, so many of the confirmation hearings, so many of all of the various judicial issues were really just proxy wars over Roe. And then it's really corrupted our culture, where we've moved from a situation where when President Clinton was in office and when he was campaigning, he would say, you know, safe, legal, and rare was his mantra. Whereas now we have people shouting their abortions. And now we have TV shows and movies and music kind of glorifying abortion. And so we conclude, you know, in the book, we wanted to do something that would equip people for this new stage of the abortion conversation, which is say, look, it's not just that abortion stops a beating heart, although it does that. It's also corrupted everything that it's touched, including how we view children in the first place. So even the children who aren't directly impacted by abortion, right? They make it out of the womb alive. We now have a culture that is very anti-natalist, very anti-child. And I think that's just another way in which abortion has really hardened our culture.
Give us a history of the Dobbs case.
Sure. I mean, so Dobbs comes down because the state of Mississippi passes a law protecting unborn babies after 15 weeks, which more or less makes the state of Mississippi's law at the most progressive end of the European consensus. It was very interesting that when the state of Mississippi went to the Supreme Court, they pointed out that it was something like 44 out of the 47 European nations had abortion laws that were more protective than Mississippi's, right? And just showed you how much of an outlier the United States was. But so they had a law protecting unborn babies after 15 weeks. One of the abortion clinics, the Jackson Women's Health Organization, brought a lawsuit saying, look, this violates Roe v. Wade, this violates Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and they were trying to get the law overturned. Then in the process of this case percolating, you know, first the district court, then the circuit court, and Mississippi loses at both of those courts because both of those courts, the district and the circuit court, were applying the precedent of Roe and Casey to this case. And they're saying, look, given what the Supreme Court has said previously, we have to strike down Mississippi's protective law. And then they filed for cert at the Supreme Court, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg was still on the court. And then after they granted cert, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away and Amy Coney Barrett was her replacement. So this then kind of changed the calculus for the lawyers for Mississippi, because what they had been arguing was, look, you can uphold our state law while leaving in place Roe and Casey. That even with Roe and Casey in place, a 15-week law is still compatible with what you've laid out as a fundamental right to abortion or undue burden test for abortion. You know, we're giving women 15 weeks to make the decision, and so it doesn't violate a fundamental right or an undue burden. Then what Mississippi did, and you know, at the time, it was a risky move. A friend of mine was the Solicitor General of Mississippi who argued the case, and so I want to give him and the Attorney General Lynch, a lot of credit, because what they said, we're going to go whole hog. And some lawyers said, oh, this is risky, you might lose. They said, no, this is our best shot in 50 years to finally overturn Roe. And so what they argued at the Supreme Court was that Roe was wrongly decided. There's nothing in our Constitution, nothing in the text, the history, the logic, American traditions that claims that there's a constitutional right to kill an unborn child in the womb. And so the Supreme Court should finally admit it got it wrong 50 years ago. And lo and behold, they prevailed. And they prevailed. I mean, realize that the vote count here was a 5-1-3, right? And so it really took Amy Coney Barrett being Ruth Bader Ginsburg's successor to get there, because the Chief Justice, he wanted to say, look, we can uphold the Mississippi law without overturning Roe and Casey, right? So he was going to say, yes, Mississippi wins, but no, we don't have to overturn anything. The three liberals dissented. They wanted to strike down the Mississippi law. And then the five conservatives said Roe and Casey were wrongly decided, and so we're getting rid of them.
So that explains, I've always wondered why the plaintiffs in Dobbs, Jackson Women's Health Organization, wanted this to go to the Supreme Court, given its conservative majority there. Essentially, they wanted it to go to the Supreme Court when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was still alive. It must have been quite a shock to see her replaced by Barrett.
So that's part of it. But what's also interesting is that since they won, so they sued at the district level and they won. And then it was Mississippi that filed an appeal to take it to the circuit level. And then it was Mississippi that filed the appeal to take it to the Supreme Court level. So there's the question of strategy here would be, should they have sued in the first place to say that the 15-week law was unconstitutional? But when they did sue, they thought, look, this law conflicts with Casey, it conflicts with Roe, and we think we have the votes in the Supreme Court to get them not to overturn it. And they might have been right had Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, it's very possible that the Chief Justice and then what would have been the four liberals would have had some plurality in which they said 15-week heartbeat bills are constitutional, but we don't have to overturn Roe and Casey. That's what some court watchers were fearful might happen even after Ginsburg was gone, that you know the Chief and Justice Kavanaugh and maybe even Justice Barrett might have formed some new plurality. Because if you recall in the Casey decision, there wasn't a majority opinion. There was a plurality opinion, and then there were two different sets at the time. It was Scalia and it was either Thomas or Rehnquist who would have fully overturned Roe. And then there were the liberals who didn't even want to move on to Casey. So we could have had a plurality opinion that could have been a compromise with then the liberals saying, we just want to keep where we were, and the conservatives saying we want to get rid of it. And instead we got what we got, which is a great step forward. It's not the goal line. It's not the finish line, but it was a necessary next step to get to the finish line.
How did abortion organizations, activists, and pro-choice lawmakers respond after the Dobbs ruling?
I mean, if we're speaking colloquially here, they more or less freaked out. And the freakout started as soon as the leak. And actually, you could even say that the leak of the draft majority opinion was the first sign. We have not had a full Supreme Court opinion leaked in modern Supreme Court history. Sometimes there have been leaks about what side of the case the court's leaning on. And, you know, a clerk or someone had a slip up when they were speaking. And so people get rumor mills start spreading about what the final outcome will be. But we've never actually had a draft of an opinion leaked in modern Supreme Court history. Then we saw all of the targeting of justice houses, right? They were being protest night after night, day after day. Eventually a deranged man showed up with a firearm at Justice Kavanaugh's house, telling police officers that he was going there to assassinate him. We had Jane's Revenge. So they're not just now harassing the actual justices. They're now going after pro-life pregnancy centers, which really puts the lie to the claim that these people are pro-choice. All pro-life pregnancy centers do is help a woman who wants to choose life, right? They're not coercing anyone. They're not in any way forcing someone to do something they don't want to do. They're simply empowering women who want to make the choice for life. And we saw several pro-life pregnancy centers, including some of the ones that, you know, my wife and I support here in the DC area, graffitied. In some cases, they were firebombed. We saw Catholic churches and other houses of worship graffitied and in some cases firebombed. And yet we've seen no arrests. Meanwhile, we've had sidewalk counselors and other kind of pro-lifers praying outside of Planned Parenthood clinics who have been swatted in the middle of the night and then taken to jail. And so just the double standard that we're seeing from the Department of Justice in terms of actual illegal activity that's been taking place post-Dobbs. And then a third area of response has just been an endless drumbeat of lies about what pro-life laws do. So there's been the response, you know, with the leak and the harassment of the justices. There's been the response really attacking pro-life pregnancy centers, houses of worship, and then a double standard with the application of law. And then finally, a response with lies about, you know, if this state passes this pro-life law, women with ectopic pregnancies or women facing a life-threatening condition won't be able to get the medical care they need. Several different institutions, including my own think tank, my co-author, Alexander DeSantis, went through every existent pro-life law and just quoted the text of each and every one, pointing out that they have explicit protections for life-saving medical care for the life of the mother. And so we've just seen a lot of throw it all against the wall and see what sticks to confuse people, to make it unclear what the truth is. And that's why in the elections, we've seen that the ballot initiatives have not gone well for pro-lifers, because we don't control the media, we don't control the airwaves, and the left can lie about these bills. But pro-life legislation in houses, you know, state houses, that has gone very well for us. And then the pro-life governors have gotten reelected with wide margins. And so when you hear people say, oh, you know, the pro-life issue is a losing issue electorally or politically, you got to look more into the details. And it's much more nuanced. And when pro-life political leaders lead on the issue, they speak on the issue, they tell the truth about the issue, as Ron DeSantis has done, as we saw not just in Florida, but in Texas, in Georgia, and in Ohio, all four governors signed very good pro-life bills into law, and they all got reelected by wide margins. It's when we don't talk about it, when we allow the left to control the messaging, that's when we lose.
Ryan Anderson is our guest. He's co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solved Nothing. When we come back, when we hear abortion supporters, including President Biden, talk about codifying Roe federally, what are they talking about?
You can call it what you like. I call it mine.
This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Memoria Press is a family-run publisher of classical Christian education materials for homeschools and private schools. Every page of the Memoria Press curriculum leads students to a mastery of content, an understanding of the classical heritage of the Christian West, and an appreciation of truth, goodness, and beauty. If you're interested in learning more, visit memoriapress.com and use the coupon code LPR23. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. memoriapress.com.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the one-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision with Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th This year's conference includes visits to the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter. Learn more at LutheransForLife.org, LutheransForLife.org. Dr. Anderson, when abortion supporters, and this includes President Biden, talk about codifying Roe federally, what are they talking about?
They're talking about actually going further than what Roe itself held, but they're talking about statutory protections at the federal level so that abortion on demand throughout all 9 months of pregnancy, possibly including the moment of pregnancy, would be legal for any reason and for no reason at all, and federally funded taxpayer funding of abortion. That's what their goal line is. They want it to be so that abortion is treated like what they view as any other type of healthcare. I don't think abortion is healthcare because I think health is about healing, not about killing. But they want it to be legal in all 50 states, abortion for any reason, for no reason at all, throughout all 9 months of pregnancy with government funding of abortion. That's what they mean by codifying Roe.
What's the best strategy for pro-lifers moving forward?
All hands on deck. The best strategy here is let a thousand flowers bloom. That means we need people working at the state level and at the federal level. That means we need people working in the culture and in the law. That means we need people working on future court cases to argue that the unborn child is a person for the purposes of equal protection of the law and the 14th Amendment. We need people working in legislation, both state legislation and federal legislation, to incrementally pass more and more protective laws until we eventually get it so that every child in the womb has their right to life protected. We need family policy so that, like both Florida and Texas have done, they've allocated money to support women who have financial needs to bring their children into the world. We need the pregnancy care centers, the pregnancy resource centers. We need all of it, right? And that's why I say it's an all hands on deck moment. Every one of us has something we can do. Then we need to bear witness to the truth. Realize that this is not going to be solved in the next election or the next year. This is going to be a matter of persuading people, persuading family members, persuading friends, possibly persuading people in our own congregations. We may have people in the pews who aren't fully pro-life. And that means we need to be able to explain the truth. I mean, that's part of the reason why Alexandra and I wrote this book, was that we want to equip people with a variety of arguments. Find out which one is going to resonate best with the person you're talking to so you can bear witness, you can have that conversation, so that then when we are eventually passing the next law, we're voting for the next pro-life administration, we actually have the numbers, the critical mass to keep incrementally moving the ball forward until we reach the final goal line.
There is a debate among pro-lifers, because you mentioned state and federal level. There's a debate among some pro-lifers regarding whether there's a need for federal legislation on abortion after Dobbs. What do you think?
Oh, of course there is. And here's the reason why. The most immediate progress is going to be made in red states. Like I mentioned, Texas, Florida, Ohio, Georgia. I mean, these are the places where we've seen good legislation enacted just within the past year or so. But what are the most populous states? Massachusetts, Illinois, New York, California, those are deep blue states, which more or less have abortion on demand. And if we want to protect children in those states, we need to have at least a federal floor, which would more or less say the whole nation is going to have at least Europe's abortion laws. And then red states can get more protective than that. That's more or less the bill that Lindsey Graham has introduced. It would be a 15-week bill that would protect babies at 15 weeks and beyond in all 50 states. And then the red states would be allowed, and the purple states for that matter, would be allowed to be even more protective. 12 weeks, 6 weeks, conception bills. So that's one response, is that there's a reason that we need federal legislation, because the blue states aren't going to protect the babies. And some of those blue states are the most populous states. Second reason is that Congress actually has this authority. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment authorizes the federal government with new powers. And we had a constitutional amendment to delegate additional power to Congress. And what it says in Section 5 is that Congress can enact legislation to guarantee the protections from the previous four sections. And the 14th Amendment is the amendment that we enacted after the abolition of slavery, 13th Amendment, which says that no state can deny to any person equal protection of law or due process of law. So if Congress judges that an unborn child is a person, it can then enact legislation to protect that person from the denial of equal protection of the law and due process of law. And that's what we're seeing right now. We are denying. We have laws that say you and I, our right to life is protected, but we're denying that equal protection to the child in the womb. So that's one argument, is that Congress can do this. But then there's also going to be an argument that the court can do this. The court can say, and the most powerful legal scholarship on this is from, you know, my other co-author within the marriage context, Robert George, a professor of jurisprudence at Princeton, and then his mentor at Oxford, John Finnis, kind of the magisterial legal philosopher at Oxford. The two of them filed an amicus brief in the Dobbs case, and then subsequently they've really expanded that and published it as a law review article, arguing that the original public meaning of the word person in the 14th Amendment included the child in the womb. Because by person, they meant human being. And we now know that the entity in the womb is a human being. And so when it says, the state shall make no law denying anyone equal protection of the law, that anyone, that person, to get the language more accurately correct, includes the unborn. And so that's why I think there's both going to be a role for the state and for federal Congress. But then there's also going to be a role for Congress, for the judiciary, the courts, and then also for the administrative state. A pro-life president could instruct his Department of Justice, his Department of Health and Human Services, his Department of State, all of the various military branches. They can all be engaged in pro-life policies. With just literally a signature on an executive order, it can say no abortion on medical basis, no abortions coming through any federally controlled entity, because the executive branch controls a whole slew of executive agency programs. So there's a lot that all three branches of the federal government and the states can be doing. And what our listeners need to do is educate ourselves and then get to the point where we can get the right people in positions of power to enact just laws. That's what we want to see here.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, founder and editor of The Public Discourse and co-author of the book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solved Nothing. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Anderson, thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, there's a new survey from Gallup on abortion views and a new report on abortions post-Dobbs. Dr. Michael New of the Charlotte Lozier Institute will tell us all about it.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, freedom, vocation, Concordia University, Chicago, cuchicago.edu.